The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Ewan Potts. Now, Caroline, I want to start the show today with a bit of fiscal news, which I know you like very much. The UK government is having to sell more debt after the deficit has come in bigger than forecast. Now, the budget deficit, which is the gap between government income and expenditure, totaled just over £120 billion in the 12 months to March. To put that in a bit of context, over the last year, the government borrowed more than £4,250 for every household in the country.
Okay. Yeah, I feel that this programme is going to be quite statistics heavy. I might have to do a little song and dance to make sure all of you listeners stay with us. But look, the data's really important, isn't it, in terms of the deficit. Look, it is an improvement, basically, on a year ago when the deficit was £128 billion. No, it's hard to even kind of conceptualise how much money that is. But this, you know, a year ago, of course, was when the government was shelling out billions of pounds on energy bill support. Having said that, it's still more than economists had forecast and more than the Office for Budget Responsibility had forecast only last month. So it also takes another big issue, the national debt, to another big number, £2.69 trillion. That is more than 98% of GDP. Those are the sorts of levels where people start to get a bit twitchy. 100% of GDP and above is really worrying. The last time we have seen this sort of level at 98% of GDP was back in the early 1960s. So it sort of just shows you why the government's got so little fiscal headroom, why it's got so little money to spend, why Jeremy Hunt is sort of so boxed in as Chancellor in terms of government spending.
Yeah, why does this matter? I guess two key reasons. Firstly is that the government cannot borrow as much as it wants. There has to be a ceiling of that. We saw that with the markets and Liz Truss attempting to go on a borrowing spree. And secondly, it matters because it's blooming expensive. I was just looking at the numbers from the House of Commons today. The government spent last year £110 billion on debt interest alone. That's just £110 billion we're throwing away on debt interest. That is 10% of all government spending, and it's about the same as we spend on education. Of course, yeah, that number has been rising because the debt's been rising.
Yes, so that's why we should all kind of worry about the figures. But also, on to another issue away from that, Rishi Sunak and the Rwanda bill, declaring the country a safe destination for asylum seekers. That issue has finally passed through Parliament. So that was the other bit of parliamentary news today. The House of Lords let the bill through after blocking it five times last night in something of a not all-nighter, but certainly a late-night standoff. There was plenty of discontent on the red benches. Now, here is Lord David Anderson, who's a crossbench peer, meaning that he doesn't sit with either Labour or the Conservatives. He was leading the charge against the government's bill yesterday.
We will, this week, have a law that provides for the offshore processing and settlement of asylum seekers in Rwanda. Its benefits remain to be seen. Its costs will be measured not only in money, but in principles debased, disregard for our international commitments, avoiding statutory protections for the vulnerable, and the removal of judicial scrutiny over the core issue of the safety of Rwanda. That is now a fact, and there is nothing more we can do about it. But there is a further principle, as precious as any of those, to which we can still hold fast. One might call it the principle of honesty in lawmaking. We are concerned with the safety of Rwanda, both in the present and in the future. This bill is honest about neither.
Lord David Anderson, worth adding that he's also a former independent reviewer of terrorism legislation in the UK. All of this means that flights to Rwanda could take off as soon as this summer. The government is talking about flights taking off sometime in July. Well, let's get more now with our UK government reporter, Alba Ray. Alba, tell us what happened yesterday and why the Lords ended up backing down in the end.
Good question, Ewan. I suppose, so what happened yesterday, first of all, is that essentially the Lords ended up backing down, as you say, and this Rwanda bill, now Rwanda Act, is on its way to becoming law within the week. I suppose the Lords ended up backing down because they are just the revising chamber, they're the second chamber. They have the right to ask the House of Commons to think again. In this case, they asked them to think again many, many times, but eventually they can't continue to block legislation. They don't have the upper hand over the House of Commons. So around midnight last night, we saw that come to a resolution.
Yeah, absolutely. But it has been enormously contentious, and you could sort of hear it from that Lord there, who's also a barrister. You could hear him kind of taking apart the legislation and putting the Lord's perspective on this. So there was a long running attempt to sort of try to change this bill. And it also sadly comes on a day where we've heard about 5 deaths in the Channel. We talk a lot about how migration has changed, grown worldwide. I think politically the question today is, has this helped or hindered Rishi Sunak in terms of what he needs to achieve sort of politically?
I think Rishi Sunak will think that this has helped him. It's in the context of a week where he's trying to get on the front foot, not just on Rwanda, but he's delivered some other speeches. He's travelling this week and will be making some key announcements on defence. We're coming up to the local elections where the Conservatives are not expected to do that well on May the 2nd. They're kind of trying to seize control of the agenda again, and they think that Rwanda is a key part of doing that because of concerns around immigration, as you say, as well as the real world impact.
Yeah, and I wonder also, a lot of focus on what happened last night. How do you think we're going to think about it come July, August, once maybe that first flight has gone?
Yes, so there are some logistical challenges still to even get to July, even though it's looking easier than it did 24 hours ago because this law has been passed. There are still some challenges before we get to that in terms of getting an airline to carry out those flights, making sure that the staff are there, and any legal challenges. But I would say that around Westminster, there is a little bit of an expectation, even though we don't know for sure, that one flight will take off in July, and that can be hailed as a big success by the government. But then any legal challenges could come into effect. And also it will take some time for Rwanda to process those arrivals. So it could be quite a while before we see another one. And we heard Rishi Sunak yesterday saying that he wanted to see a steady flow of flights to have a deterrent effect. And it's not really guaranteed that we'll have that for quite some time. So I think that we're maybe looking at a summer where we are debating whether there's any deterrent effect. And the stats might be a little bit difficult to read because we know that this is quite dependent just on the weather. So actually, we might find that we have conflicting narratives about how much this has really moved the dial.
Clearly, the government's very pleased that this has finally got through Parliament. That's the success for the Prime Minister. He's invested a huge amount of political capital in this. But on the wider issue, do you think that the PM slightly boxed himself in? Because the pledge wasn't to deport some people to Rwanda. The pledge was to stop the boats. And the boats aren't going to stop, are they?
Yes, and fascinating, Ewan, that yesterday in a press conference, he essentially said unprompted that success will look like stopping the boats. So he's reiterated that that's the standard we should hold him to. It's looking difficult for all sorts of reasons. The evidence on the effect of a deterrent like this is quite mixed. You know, you could pluck statistics from either way. If someone from the government were here, they would say, well, look at our Albania scheme, which is a little bit different. That has had a deterrent effect, but it's really not guaranteed. And, you know, if people are crossing the channel risking their lives to come yes. here already, will the threat of being sent to Rwanda after present a new deterrent that isn't already there? It's really not clear.
Yes, I mean, you know, I think that is very difficult to know, isn't it? Look, the opposition, you know, the Labour Party, and their criticism, and many lines of criticism, but one of them being on the cost of all of this, that the cost actually of this policy, you know, does it outweigh the benefits?
Yes, because it is so expensive. And if, as we were saying, Caroline, there's just one flight in July with maybe 100 or 200 people, then that's a huge cost. You can do the math, but like an absolutely massive cost per person who is deported.
Yeah, I mean, I would even say that you're then dealing with the issue on virtually a case-by-case basis, were that to be the case.
So again, the government would say it's not so much about the cost of the individual people, it's the deterrent effect. Mm. And so sort of stopping people over time making those crossings in the first place. But it is very expensive, and the wider asylum system is under quite a lot of strain. You know, the government policy means that anyone who arrives in the UK without prior permission, who arrives quote-unquote illegally, cannot have their asylum claim accepted, with a few exceptions, which means that we now have to detain all of the thousands of people who arrive that way. That's, you know, we know that there isn't much space in prisons. That's a huge pressure on the asylum system. There's a lot of controversy, as we know, around housing asylum seekers in hotels, but then housing them elsewhere is quite expensive in sort of former army bases. So we're spending a lot of money on that too. It's a really complex system. And I think even speaking to Labour people, I think they know that this will be a big challenge for them if they win the election after.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that, actually. What have Labour said about their plans for tackling this issue? Because they've said that they would scrap Rwanda, haven't they? But have they been clear on what they would put in its place?
So they say that their focus is preventing this at source. So you kind of try to go upstream. So working with the French more, working with the countries where some of these people are coming from in the first place, which I think the government would say is what they have also already been trying to do. I did a lot of work on this for a piece last year, and it does seem like the cooperation of the French is quite key on this. Mm. So I think that Labour will be hoping that they can do more, essentially pay the French more, reading between the lines of the policy. That's not their official position, but essentially pay the French more to man that border even more than they are already doing. But actually, there is still work going on behind the scenes for Labour. They know that the current plans that they have are just a part of the picture, and in government, they'll maybe introduce more.
Yeah, absolutely. A very thorny issue then, isn't it, for Rishi Sunak, for the government. And then we haven't even sort of touched on the difference between illegal, as you, you know, air quoted it, versus legal migration and, you know, net migration into the UK, which is even a sort of separate issue, but perhaps one that voters conflate, confuse, or see as part of the same basket. Alva, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate your time today on the podcast. The UK government, or our UK government reporter, Alva Ray, much appreciated for that. I mean, there are still going to be many questions then, and I suspect that the Rwanda bill and the fallout is something we'll continue to follow over the summer.
Yeah, I think there's a problem of timing for the government here, because a bit like the economy coming good as we go through the year, I think this policy, to have any chance of working, if it does, is going to take time. So come the election, whenever it is, it will probably still only just be getting underway. So I think that's a bit of a problem for the government.
So the UK's export mix is changing, Ewan, and it's something I want to talk about this morning. Post-Brexit, the volume of services exports has continued to rise. Now, this is according to the UK's ONS data. Goods export volumes, though, are still below 2013 levels. Now, the Department for Business and Trade are trying to focus on the UK's successes and celebrate international sales of small and medium-sized businesses. And so on that topic, joining us this morning is UK Export Minister Malcolm Offord. Lord Offord, thank you so much for being with us. I want to start, though, by talking about the biggest political news this morning. We've been talking about the Rwanda bill on the programme just earlier. So the issue of deporting a few hundred asylum seekers, potentially, that has taken a couple of years of government time. On the issue of legal migration and how that relates to SMEs and to business, hospitality, SMEs, Andy Haldane, they've all called for a more lenient approach because we need to fill job vacancies in the UK. Businesses need talent to grow the economy. I wonder what you think the message from the Rwanda bill is to businesses here in the UK.
I think there's job vacancies in every economy. Germany, Australia, the US. One of the things that's come through in the modern economies post-COVID is an understanding that businesses are now understanding that one of the most prized commodities is actually their workforce. Skilled labor, technical skills are now at a premium. And we have got, as I'm sure you've covered in other programs, we have got 33 million people working in the UK at 66 million. So that is a good working economy. But we also have a large number of people of working age not working. We need to help them to get skills to get back into employment. I think that's where our focus should be rather than immigration.
Lord Offen, I want to ask you about another issue which has impacted businesses of all sizes. Why has the government now delayed post-Brexit checks on EU food imports a total of six times?
Well, this is part of the post-Brexit arrangements. What's happening here is that our trade is booming across the whole of the world, and we've an issue with 24% of our pie chart, and that 24% is manufactured goods to the EU 27, right? The other 76% is going gangbusters, but the difficulties arise and the friction around the 24%, the EU 27, and that's just taking some time to process. And we at DBT are trying to avoid putting hurdles in front of business. We're trying to cut down the amount of red tape and bureaucracy. And so we're continually trying to make sure we have light touch. This is why it's being revised for the benefit of our companies.
I mean, the UK, though, factually has had a worsening trade balance with the rest of the world since 2010. So things have become, you know, by some measures, a lot more difficult. There are fears that the checks, and we followed this quite closely, could cause delays to food imports into the UK, that they could push up prices. The government's own stats has kind of conceded that it could mean some food price inflation, 0.2%, because of them. Are you concerned that, again, this kind of EU issue could mean that either food is held up at ports or that there are shortages on the shelves or that it means inflation? I mean, is that why we've seen so many delays? Could that still happen?
No, I think I'm not concerned about that. I think at the end of the day, the EU now is being very practical with this. Post the Northern Ireland Protocol, we've now got the green lane, the red lane. We've now got digital trade. We've now got the trusted trader schemes. Trade is now passing fast. In fact, didn't the chief executive of the Channel Tunnel recently say that trade is now moving through the Channel Tunnel faster now than we're in the EU? So I think it's going to be light touch. It's a very good news story. That's what's happening in our exports. I mean, we're booming here. We've just gone from seventh in the world to fourth exporter in the world. Only now US, China and Germany are ahead of us. We're good at exporting because we make goods and services that people want around the world. And that's what whenever I do trade shows abroad, that's the message that I consistently get.
You say that trade's booming. Isn't it a more nuanced pitch than that, in that trade in services is booming? Actually, the trade in goods is not booming. The flow of goods, according to the ONS, in and out of the UK has been reduced over the past 5 years.
Yes, but our economy is now 80% services and 20% goods. In fact, in terms of employment, 80% of our workforce now employs services. We're not manufacturing the way we used to in the industrial world. 80% of our GDP is services. The fact that our manufactured goods still remain 45% of our exports tells you how good our goods are. And they go around the world, and they're outstanding quality, and people continue to want them. So we are tilting. We're just tilting to where the trade is, and we're tilting to a modern economy, which is 80% services.
Is that a problem for some of the left-behind parts of the country, which the government says it wants to level up, in that the things that we're good at, many of the services exports, are heavily focused in London and the southeast and on richer parts of the country, and poorer parts of the country cannot keep up with that?
So, no, it's the exact opposite, actually. So we have 2.5 million VAT registered companies in the UK, SMEs. They are the lifeblood of the economy. They employ 60% of the workforce and provide 50% of our revenue. And 70% of those are based outside of London and South East. And they are providing services as well as goods to the world. And wherever I take them on trade missions, they come from Yorkshire, they come from Belfast, they come from Glasgow. And that reflects in our 10 award winners, of which only one's from London.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we're having an argument about the statistics. I mean, we're just basing the questions on the ONS data that we have to hand. But look, I know also that the UK sometimes, and we in the UK have a bit of a tendency to talk ourselves down. So I do want to give you an opportunity just to kind of shout about the UK success story and who you've been championing. I mean, I note that in those award winners, 4 are goods companies and 6 are services-based companies.
Well, I mean, if you take the Monroe vehicles in Glasgow, there they are, based in East Kilbride, manufacturing, designer manufacturing, fully electric commercial vehicles, and they're exporting 100% to the EU27. And they're not having a problem exporting to the EU27. You know, so if you look at our pie chart of exports, you know, 41%, we still sell 41% of our goods and services to the EU27, 49% if you make it the EU34. So 50% of our exports are still going to Europe, 20% to the USA, and 30% to the rest of the world. So these are small companies on the face of it, but they are well-managed businesses with good products. And they're selling internationally around the world. It's a good news story.
The government, probably for obvious reasons, has been focusing in the last few years on new export markets outside the European Union. But isn't it important for companies in the UK to have support in exporting to the European Union, which is the world's biggest single market and on our doorstep?
So, as I said, 49% of our exports go to the EU34, 41% to EU27. Still trading very, very, very well with the EU on all levels. In fact, if you look at our manufactured goods have gone down. You pointed that out. That's down, but that's compensated by our services being up. But if you look at the numbers, our trade in manufactured goods to the rest of the world versus EU is exactly the same. So Brexit's not been a factor.
The issue, though, I mean, the UK is growing its services exports, yes, and that is good news. But, I mean, that is partly down to necessity post-Brexit. Also, there is a concern, again, looking at the data, that relying more on services and on exporting services to Europe actually means for more volatile exports. That was something that came out of the pandemic, and that there is concern that actually the UK is going to need to be far more focused on this and have a better and stronger industrial strategy in order to meet the demands from abroad. It's, you know, the country needs to be far more dynamic if it's going to export services successfully.
If our economy is 20% manufactured goods, but we're exporting 45%, that tells you our manufacturing sector is in very, very good place, very strong place. If we then look at our services, they're going around the world. We've just joined the CPTPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, last time I looked at the map, UK wasn't anywhere near the Pacific Ocean, and yet that's where the growing trade is. And that block is 15% of GDP and 40% of middle-class consumers. So, I mean, I was on a trade mission down to Chile, right? Take Chile, okay, long way away from here, longest coastline in the world. It takes 3 weeks to drive from the top to the bottom, right? They've got a massive opportunity to do green hydrogen, and we're going to help them do that. I took 12 UK companies down to help them with that, of whom 8 were service companies, 4 were manufacturing companies. A massive opportunity to help Chile drive green hydrogen. That is the sort of thing that is going on in UK economy. From all around the UK, services is definitely on the up.
Has the flow of trade deals dried up a little bit? We had a small flurry of trade deals a couple of years ago, but the big ones, the US, India, still seem out of reach. What progress are we making on those?
Well, the US is not doing any trade deals with anybody at the moment, so put that to one side. In fact, what we're doing is really clever with the US, because instead of that, we're doing a state-by-state MOUs. We've now signed up 7 MOUs with the likes of Florida, North Carolina, et cetera, Utah. We're doing that on a state-by-state basis. When we left the EU, we've got to remind ourselves, that was actually a trade deal, right? That was the first trade deal we did. We got tariff-free trade with the EU27. And then with that, we rolled over 65 country deals, 65 individual country deals. We've now done new deals with the likes of Australia and New Zealand, up to 73 countries, which covers 60% of world trade, tariff-free, right? Now, the last big economies, clearly, the 3 big mega economies, US, China, and India, okay? India, we're working on, we're 95% of the way done, but the 5% is the most difficult 5%. You always leave the most difficult negotiation to the end. So there's elections on there at the moment. That's a factor. So we've made a lot of progress with India, but not there yet. But in terms of the 60% that signed up, we're in a very strong position.
I mean, the UK, though, is still struggling to plug the hole that's left by EU demand in terms of kind of goods and services. I mean, the overall
There's been no drop in the EU numbers. The EU numbers are the goods are down 13% to the EU and they're down 13% to the rest of the world. The biggest impact on our manufactured goods was not Brexit. It was COVID, Ukraine, inflation, energy prices. The same in Australia, the same in Germany, the same in America. Well, it's not a Brexit issue. If you look at our services to the EU, they're up 8%. The rest of the world up 19%. That is astonishing growth.
Would it be fair to say that charting a path for UK exports post-Brexit has proved more difficult than many people are expecting?
No, not when you talk to the export champions. I mean, you talk to those 10 companies. If you go through their numbers, they're exporting one company's 70% to the rest of the world, another company's 90% to the rest of the world. One's 50-50 EU rest of the world. This one's 91% rest of the world. This next one's 85% rest of the world. The only people who are concerned about the EU seems to be in London. If you go around the country, people see the world as a much bigger opportunity.
Malcolm Offord, thank you so much for being with us. That was the UK Export Minister, Lord Offord, there speaking to us. Look, I just want to go back to the statistics. Because, of course, you know, you can argue about them and around them a great deal. But if you look at the ONS data, trade with the EU has dipped. It has dropped overall since 2010, if you look at it as a percentage of GDP. And that, to my mind, is the most important figure. It does show that trade with the EU is actually dropping and that has been, you know, a significant concern. So, you know, you can pass the data and there are lots of angles. And yes, it is a kind of global phenomenon that countries are moving more towards services exports. But does it really, you know, make up for the loss in goods trade? Does it become more volatile or not? I think there are still many questions. And obviously, you know, the government minister is trying to say that it's not an effect of Brexit.
Yeah, it's one of those areas of economic data which is enormously complex, I think more so than many other things. And interesting that the minister there was saying that it's to do with the pandemic, which of course was an enormous shock to global trade, and to do with Ukraine and the post Ukraine spike in prices we saw. So he says it's not to do with Brexit. And of course, looking at the board statistics, you can't really prove that either way. So I think that's just one which listeners will have to judge. Caroline's pulling a bit of a face at me there.
Yeah.
But it is quite difficult to disentangle the things, though, isn't it?
Yes and no. I still think that you can look at the kind of bold numbers and you can absolutely read the impact. And but anyway, perhaps we shall leave it there on that minister's note. I think it's pretty interesting at least to be able to have that back and forth and understand the government's perspective on this issue. Hugely important for businesses and for jobs in Britain.
Mm.
That's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so that other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Walcock and our audio engineer was Sean Gostomachia. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Caroline Hepke and we'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.